At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1-cubic-foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Happy Maundy Thursday. Maundy Thursday, is that how it's pronounced? I didn't grow up celebrating this tradition, so I'm not overly familiar with the lingo, including how certain words are pronounced in English language. But it's also another holiday, which I am more culturally familiar with, and that's Lone Bulwark Day, which is the 2-year anniversary of the famous quote from Wolf about white evangelicals being the lone bulwark against moral insanity in the United States. The famous 11 words, and which I paraphrased just now. So that's going to be part of the theme today, because we're going to talk about some, you know, some mobilization of some stuff going on in the church world and the broader culture tonight. And that involves the Judaizers. That involves the feds. And a certain Fed in particular, as well as we're going to have a more jovial celebration of Lone Bulwark Day tonight. Anthony, how are you doing?
All is well. You know, I contributed quite a bit to the Fed stuff and bringing a lot of new things to the table that, you know, were probably buried underneath the surface that, you know, people might have known but not quite connected all the dots. So certainly excited to talk about that. Have been digging into Rush Juni, so that's another thing on the side, but. So that should be an interesting read.
Yeah, I am almost done Andrew Torba's book. I'm like 30 pages out from the ending of it. So I'm going to hopefully have some book reviews. And then I have The Sin of Empathy. This book finally shipped and got to me. It is short, but the type font is it's a little denser. Some of the font looks pretty small in there. But it's a very short book. It's like a 100 and something, well, low end of 100. So not a huge book at all. So hopefully I can get that one cranked out. Torba's book was longer than you would have thought for the material that it was. And I have a lot to say about that. But also, it's going to be a hard thing to review because I'm just not a subject matter expert in what he's talking about. And even after reading his book, I didn't necessarily become one either. So anyway, let's start out with the Fed story. And the Fed story is, to me, pretty interesting because we're going to be talking about a man named Brian Auten. We're going to be kind of exposing him because he has kind of been exposed. And that's a very wonderful development. Brian Auten is the person who's responsible for the term evangelical dark web. So a lot of people have wondered why it is that this is called evangelical dark web. And there's a reason for that, and it starts out with the Brian Auten. So here we go. This is an article I wrote in 2019, so it was kind of the origins of evangelical dark web. It officially became a thing in 2021. That's when evangelical dark web became like a real thing. Like, you know, it was a little bit more than just a website at that point that, you know, I was going to make it out into something. So, but before that, Brian Auten wrote an article called let me actually pull it up. It's this article called, and this is on the Wayback Machine, it's Notes on the Evangelical Dark Web. And he published it on a liberal website called Mere Orthodoxy, which is just liberal sludge. Jake Mador is the head over there. He's one of the personalities over there. Super liberal. He dresses like Homer Simpson when he decided to get like well over 300 pounds.
Yeah, Homer Simpson when he was disabled fat, not just regular fat.
Yeah, that is how he dresses, apparently. That's like his profile pic and all that. Anyway, so we can read this article in its entirety. This is Brian Auten who wrote this, and he's a Fed, but he posed as an evangelical influencer to some degree. And you know a little bit more about how to classify him, but let's just read this article because it's short. We'll start out with the preface from Jake Mader. The evangelical dark web is a designation adopted by a group of evangelical social media personalities and bloggers centered around a few various websites such as For the New Christian Intellectual. You know who that is? That is Cody Leibolt and Jacob Brunton. Man, they used to be kind of cool
people,
back
not
in the
people
day.
You associate with.
And now they just kind of hate they hate half the other people on this list. There's a clear divide on the list of names that we're going to point out. Pulpit and Pen. So they don't really identify as Christian nationalist over there, but they are very friendly to Christian nationalism in general. Well,
but they're also in the whole sphere of discernment bloggers that are going after all these establishment evangelical types. And again, that's part of what this whole debate is. Of Brian Auten was just like their regime evangelical federal agent. He was basically like a subject matter expert on all things, you know, federal investigation, intelligence. He was basically like their guy.
And that plays into this article, by the way. So Pulpit and Pen, and I didn't realize that J.D. Hall was so based back in those days. Because I remember this article at the time. It's September 2019. It's when I'm kind of getting into all this stuff. Sovereign Nations, that's Michael O'Fallon. Again, someone who's also playing ball with the regime these days. And Enemies Within the Church. That's a couple names behind that. So Judd Saul is one of the names behind that. Sam Jones, I believe, is affiliated with them. There's a couple other people, but those are kind of...
But again...
And Kerry Gordon. Was a pastor behind that.
But because, I mean, again, they're not...
They're still good guys, by the way.
Yeah, they're still good guys, but they're not notoriously known for being as politically active or...
No, Judd Saul is passionate about the Nigerian Christian cause, and he's doing quite well. Like, I've kind of followed his journey learning the game of Christian nonprofits, and I think he's going to just go and out the whole industry of the Christian nonprofits one day, but... You know, he's got some stories to tell about this.
But because he's exposing all the evangelicals that are more or less sold out or softly pushing progressivism in the church, because he cites Al Mohler, Tim Keller, and I forget who else in Enemies Within the Church.
But yeah, those are two of the big ones.
Yeah, he cites those two major names.
Yeah. And it came out in late 2021, I think, is when that documentary came out. At least that's when I hope that documentary came out. If it came out any later, but maybe it was 20. It could not have come out that late. Anyway, and he says one could, but the good thing that came out of Enemies Within the Church was Megan Basham. Like, she got radicalized by that movie. So one could assert that the self-proclaimed evangelical dark web is insurgent in character. Its overall aim is institutional takeover. Its intermediate aim is intellectual capture of the target population, 18 to 30-year-old conservative evangelicals, particularly males. So I don't know how much at the time Evangelical Dark Web was a self-proclaimed name. Evangelical Dark Web is a play off of Intellectual Dark Web. So there's a play, it's a internet joke, for lack of a better term. But obviously Evangelical Dark Web is better than Intellectual Dark Web, because none of the people in the Intellectual Dark Web have really stood
the test of time. They've all fallen off a cliff, except for maybe Joe Rogan.
That would be the only exception, even though he apologized for dropping a hard R back in the day, which is pretty weak, if you ask me. But other than that, like, Joe Rogan, he's still doing Joe Rogan things, and more power to him, I guess. But so,
I mean, as far as the target audience goes, well, that's kind of like the most important audience in any generation at any point in time. Because again, 18 to 30 year old males, those are your military, your prime military age fighting men. And I mean, if we extrapolate that a little bit more, I mean, 18, I think it's like 18 to 45 is your target demo for any form of entertainment. So any TV show that actually wants to aspire to be great needs 18 to 45 year old men to watch it.
Any movie
doesn't matter.
Any movie that wants to make a lot of money at the box office needs that demographic as well. So we're actually more powerful of a demographic, despite the fact that the media hates us.
And again, I mean, there, I know it was, you know, I forget who said it, but I'm sure multiple people have said it. But yeah, it's like young white men are the greatest natural resource the country has, or this country has. So,
yay.
Young members of the Lone Bulwark are the most valuable resource the church has.
Yeah,
and they're the ones being targeted for a lot of the content. But obviously, if you look at, you know, metrics for this channel and everyone else's channel, it's going to have a lot of Gen X and millennial as well.
Yeah, this channel actually, the live streams skew younger, but overall, this channel is not like, you would think that this channel has a much younger audience than it actually does. I can tell you the numbers because, I mean, I can't tell you them off the top of my head right now, but it's not.
You've already done it before.
I've done it. I posted things on social media about what the numbers are because I am relatively transparent about how the behind the scenes of YouTube works and stuff like that. But yeah, this audience skews older than a lot of our detractors would think. You know, what's his name? James White, and how he thinks I need to get spanked because I'm 14 years old or something. So, but he doesn't realize that I'm influencing people that are maybe older than him, or at least informing them. I don't know about influence, but informing them about what's going on in the world of evangelicalism. One person put it nicely at the conference is like, I'm the TLDR channel of, you know, of evangelicalism. You know, too long, didn't read. So that's what I do for people. Anyway, so its strategy is multi-form and typical for insurgencies. This is Brian Auten writing about our strategy. So he has 5 bullet points. Embarrass the regime in power.
I mean, okay. For quite frankly, they embarrass themselves.
That's true, but we make the memes, though. They step on the rakes, but we make the memes. Number 2, make it the regime appear weak and corrupt.
Again,
it's self-evident.
They do that to themselves. I mean, you literally have grown men acknowledging that, like, you know, at the Gospel Coalition or in Christianity Today, acknowledging, doing the whole, you know, gay people deserve rights thing. Like, that's weak.
No, that's Michael Bird.
Carl Truman, even.
Yeah.
You know, they're platforming women on prominent evangelical, I guess, entertainment or circles. They're just platforming women. Like, that, what, how do you appeal weaker than that?
To talk about what?
Oh, just in general. Just platforming women in theology. And talk about appearing weak and effeminate.
Okay. And then we got create zones of counter control. So this would mean like our own safe, I don't want to say safe spaces, but places where we can actually gather and have influence.
I mean, you know, if anything,
Andrew Torba made Gab, which was actually pretty effective. Gab is one of the best social media websites for Evangelical Dark Web, the website. We have a lot of success sharing our stories on Gab.
I'm not quite sure if that was a thing when he wrote this original article, if you know what I'm saying.
Because
a lot of,
Joel
Webbin's conference only took off in the last, I think this is the second conference he's done. Obviously, I mean, maybe the Fight Laugh Feast crew, they've done their conferences only a couple of years. That's probably what a post 2020.
What if this is really only about group chats?
Yeah, it might be more about that then. Those spicy group chats.
But I'm pretty sure some of my detractors, like I'm pretty sure Joel Berry's in a group chat talking about me at times, because you know it's kind of crazy when you see a bunch of people go after me at once. And it's like Joel Berry, then someone else. It's like I feel like they're in group chats together.
Yeah, coordinated effort.
Yeah,
that's a real thing on both. Anyone who actually has influence on social media does it.
So tempt the regime in power to over-respond in heavy-handed or inept manner.
Again, this is entirely self-imposed. A lot of these people have egos, and that's why they respond. That's why they step on the rake. That's why James White goes after a non-account with like 50 followers in an eggshell PFP because, again, it's an ego trip.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If you're talking about punching down on social media, but if we're talking about government institutions or even church institutions, they aren't doing this at all. Like, we haven't really tempted them to do this. I don't really think this has withstood the test of time. But I do think if you're talking about people on social media embarrassing themselves because they're punching down and then clown themselves doing so, yes, that has been done. You know, that's Joel not Barry, 130,000 followers or whatever, Joel Barry, and he's punching down at me. And you do, or Steve Dace, trying to punch down at me. That doesn't make you look good. That only helps me, actually. So I'm happy to take the punches because, you know, that's how the game is played. But yeah, the punching down actually elevates the person that you're down punching. There's, you know, I won't go after people that I think are way smaller than me, you know, because that's punching down.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is not even what we're trying to do. This is just what they're too stupid to do. They're too stupid and prideful that they do this.
I'll give an example. So Janet Mefford, I think I would actually be punching down if I just went after her. Now, there are certain times when you can punch down to make an example out of someone and actually do really well. Most people think they're doing that, but that's not usually what they do. But so I think I don't trade barbs with Janet Mefford often because it just doesn't do the numbers because it's just punching down. There's no real reason to do that. She ran a radio show that she may have paid for the slot to have aired. And, you know, she didn't have any real influence as a result of that and is frustrated that she has less than 5,000 followers or whatever. And she's made a lot of enemies with the people that she otherwise could have been supportive of because she was against wokeness until, I guess, it came after feminism, is my read. But anyway, you can't really punch down at that. So there's just an example.
You haven't read the last one.
Okay, last bullet point. Through expansion of captured target population over time, overwhelm the regime. Well, yeah, I think we're doing that. I think that, so was it 4 out of 5 are pretty accurate? I'll give 4.5 of these bullet points is correct.
I'll say most of them are self-imposed. That if they actually were competent elites, they would not be falling into these traps.
That they are correct is true, but why they are correct, yeah. These are incidental because at the end of the day, liberals just aren't competent with power.
I mean, technically that fifth point is basically the result of their ineptitude and incompetence. If they're actually competent, if they're actually convincing, if their arguments were actually persuasive, they wouldn't actually lose the younger generation and lose that audience. Because they're essentially saying they're losing market share.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't be losing market share if they were actually good at their jobs.
So its primary tactic, the rhetorical hammer. I'm actually not as convinced that's true because I think we're in a post-debate world and have been since 2020. This was written in 2019, so I can understand. But in a post-debate world, it's more about mocking the other side. Rather than debating,
delegitimization.
Yes. It's not really about debating ideas anymore because we're past that. We're beyond debates. There are helpful debates, like the debate between David Reese and Stephen Wolf. I thought was a helpful debate. But the debate that went on tonight between Samuel Say and Corey Mahler, was that a helpful debate? Well, I guess we'll find out, but. A lot of these debates just
word on the street is it was again, it makes Chris Roseborough look like a Mensa, if you understand what I'm saying.
I do not, but one day,
130 plus IQ.
Oh, really?
How bad Samuel Say performed.
Well, that's the word on the street. I predicted that, but maybe I'll do a video about that on Monday. So, granting that characterization, an obvious question for those of Orthodox Protestant Christians who reject the evangelical dark web is how to effectively counter insurgency against the evangelical dark web. These are some embryonic thoughts. Now let's talk about whether they did this or not in fighting the evangelical dark web as a broader movement, not just me, but as a broader movement. Because as the entrepreneur that I am, I took this article, registered the domain name, like, this is something. This could be something. And here we are years later. So counterinsurgency has three traditional components: isolate and degrade insurgent activity, build target audience resiliency, strengthen, defend, and counter radicalize. And lastly, if and where needed, reform the at-risk regime. Wow. So he has three things, and maybe they've accomplished the first one, but the latter two they've utterly failed at. I'm going to say that they haven't really done well to isolate and degrade insurgent activity.
No, I mean, that's part of the
statistics are that young men are more right wing than their predecessors. So that's
also where, like, the notion of anons being very effective comes in. And yeah, there's some extent that no one is actually anonymous. I was kind of listening to that earlier this week, but you know, the government knows who you are. Twitter knows who you are in real life. So, but as far as, like, the ability to be anonymous and wage attacks that, and, you know, just as the founding fathers did back in their day, where they made it more about the ideas versus the personality.
Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, you know, they weren't saying, look at me, I'm Hamilton, or I'm John Adams or John Jay. They're saying, I'm Publius. So,
yeah, I don't know why they identified with Brutus. I think he's the bad guy in the story.
I mean, Anons.
We do see Anons identify with villains at times.
But Anons basically prevent them from actually isolating the insurgents. But even at the same time, I mean, when you have someone like Stephen Wolf that's out in the open, anytime they try to isolate and attack him, he just gets stronger.
Yeah. I mean, the guy is a pro. And he's an intellectual heavyweight and a very thoughtful guy at that. But yeah, I don't think they've done well to isolate, because you're right about the Anons thing is why that didn't work. And building a target audience resiliency, I'm sorry, if you tell me that you get if a young guy tells me that he gets inspiration from Russell Moore, I just think he's going to be gay.
Well, again, when you're looking at who the lone bulwark being the young white those young 18 to 30 year old white evangelical lone bulwarks,
actually, well,
that's also the most competent demographic.
You know who the poster child for this, though, the strategy is, though, for building target audience resiliency, who is their counter insurgent poster child is? You know who this is?
Is this a Doug Wilson in Moscow?
No, this is Gavin Ortland. That's what Gavin Ortland's role is. So, you know, why do I go after Gavin Ortland a lot for being a hardcore liberal? Because this is his role.
Yes, he's supposed to be appealing to the youth while also having a huge veneer of legitimacy.
He is supposed to Russell Moore the next generation, because Russell Moore could not reach the young people. The Russell Moore for millennials and Zoomers. That is who Gavin Ortland is. He is the build target audience resiliency, strengthen, defend, and counter radicalize. That is his role.
I mean, is Redeem Zoomer in that role?
Redeem Zoomer is
even not saying not he's outside, yeah, the outside the regime, but incidentally. But does he fill that role even accidentally?
He is so liberal that he doesn't realize how liberal he is, because I guess he's from New York, like he's a city dweller, he's a Yankee. New York. I know. So yeah, but he's gonna end up functionally being that because he doesn't have enough life experience and he's not a historian. I'll just leave it at that. So he's not, I mean, he's naturally born American, as far as I understand, but still. Let's move on with the rest of the article, because we only got, eight more bullet points to talk about. For countering the evangelical dark web particularly, these steps will need to be taken. One, demand citations and evidence for every assertion. Demand context for every pull quote. Fact check every infographic and force them back to the original sources at every possible juncture. So citation, not seeing people, I guess.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if this
called
is
back in the day.
I don't know if this is in reference to like Holocaust memes or whatever, but at the end of the day, I mean, when someone posts a quote of like Calvin or whatever, or even Stephen Wolf doing the whole nature or grace, you know, perfects nature, dualism. Well, again, he's going back to the original sources. I mean, part of what's radicalizing the youth, so to speak, is a Protestant retrieval project, which is that people are going back to the original sources. They're reading the philosophers. A lot of, you know, even people I know on just a personal level, they're reading, they're doing the readings, and that's why they're being pulled. If anything, this is why a lot of young people are rejecting dispensationalism, for example, Zionism. They're going back to the original sources. They're actually doing the reading. They're not just watching TBN and insert your Christian televangelism network and getting their theology from a bunch of idiots.
Yeah, I mean, you can actually learn theology on the internet now, where maybe you could have in 2004, but fewer people were interested. Let's just leave it at that. But yeah, you know, one way to make a lot of people mad is to quote the Bible, but don't cite the Bible on social media. So if you just, you know, put a Bible verse, but don't put the fact that it's from the Bible, you will make a lot of people upset.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Number two, question all characterizations every time. If someone says, if they say someone is a socialist or a cultural Marxist, always make them define the term and support the assertion with evidence.
That's a failed strategy.
Yeah, it didn't work.
If you try to implement it.
We got number three, interrogate the interrogator. Research, write, and post accurate stories about the individuals and groups in the evangelical dark web. What things have they been involved with in the past, previous attempts of this type of activity? How do they get their funding? It's the Qataris. Everyone's getting that Qataris money. I mean, just those Qataris and their hat and their wall.
And their country looks like a nose.
It kind of does, doesn't it? Yeah, it's the Qataris.
Now, I don't know if you could say that they kind of did this with J.D. Hall when obviously a lot of his stuff went down. That might have been, and obviously they did try.
No, this is more like Eli McGowan.
Yeah, that was going to go there too. But yeah, a lot of times, you know, you'll see that people are trying to report on that kind of stuff, even though, I mean, a lot of their detractors have far worse scandals.
Yeah, I mean, this is the whole let's dox people for being anonymous and having normal views. Or, you know, let's go after Thomas Acord for some of the most hilarious tweets that have ever been tweeted. Like, that's what this is. Host number four. Host college and young career fellowship content analysis viewing parties. This sounds really gay. Get some food, a copy of the upcoming social justice infiltration video. A local speaker familiar with 20th century U.S. evangelical history, political theology, and or the history of ideas, and slowly walk the audience through the video itself. Discuss framing, the quality of the evidence and argumentation in the backgrounds of the documentary's backers, host, and take talking heads.
I don't know anyone that's actually, anyone that's actually tried to do this. This is just a woke struggle session.
Yeah.
More or less. I mean, again, the people that you actually saw attempt anything like this are, I mean, it would be this guy right here, Brian Alton, which I don't know if we'll get to that later. But yeah, he's the type of guy that will, you know, give you the woke lesson of,
in other words, losers. History,
or 20th century history.
People that don't have lives. Like, if you got time for that, you don't have a life. And number five, fight the temptation to get certain outlets or personalities to do battle on your behalf. A critique of the evangelical dark web by the Gospel Coalition, ERLC, New York Times, Washington Post, or Southern Poverty Law Centers, or a byline by Emma Green, Peter Weiner, John Fay, Warren Throckmorton. I know who that is. He's like a gay affirming psychology professor at like Wheaton or something like that. Or is it Grove City? Which, again, one of these fake conservative institutions has Warren Throckmorton as a professor at. Anyway, will backfire and easily become ammunition for the next round of attacks.
Well, they have not learned this lesson. You still got David French writing, pieces for the New York Times. You still have Phil Williams, creeping on people in Tennessee. They're still writing articles and basically giving ammunition. You've even seen like the 60 Minutes pieces.
He's talking about institutional heads, which I don't think the Philip guy in Tennessee is, but the Gospel Coalition does not wade into relevant issues very often anymore. They've actually relented on this.
Well, I'm thinking more like anytime the major media players get involved, it is just ammunition. Again, sometimes the liberal media is more honest than the so-called evangelical elites.
Yeah. Like that one chick who wrote the Chronicle or whatever, that wrote a very friendly article about the people that influence J.D. Vance and stuff like that. She wrote an article that was very friendly in some ways. But she had to come out after she wrote that article and said, I hate these people too. Let's see. Get solid material on intellectual and social history into the hands of your 18 to 30-year-old. Someone's less likely to accept conspiratorial assertions about the undue influence of the Frankfurt School if they've actually read Richard Wallen, who, if you host a book club, offer a recent biography of Stokely Carmichael or Lillian Callas Barger's just published History of Liberation Theology. Help your young adults understand the context of ideas.
So again, this is
who are these people?
Oh, this is basically just propaganda. Oh, liberation theology is not as bad as it is. Basically just accept the anti-white programming you've been fed your entire lives that you're starting to reject. We need to get you back on the programming.
And yeah, that's largely
don't notice who the names in the Frankfurt School were.
Yeah.
The fact that he actually mentions that, don't notice anything.
Because that's what's going on in the last few years. First of all, white people white people are not hating themselves anymore.
Yeah, you're seeing
that's one thing that's going on.
Yeah, you're seeing this a lot this past week and a week or two with the Carmelo Anthony situation.
Yeah, white people we're not going to hate ourselves anymore. And if we get white people to stop hating themselves, the Democrat Party's toast. Unfortunately, some generations are going to have to go for that to happen. But the young generation, we've gotten them to stop hating themselves. And that's a good thing. Number two, they saw who the purveyors of wokeness and socialism were in the United States context, which is the Frankfurt School. And they noticed who all these people were. Oh, they're Jews that escaped Weimar Germany because they were going to face the consequences for Weimar Germany. So they escaped. And then they came to America and brought their bad ideas with them. So, yeah, people noticed that. And then they noticed everything else. Let's see. Number seven, be transparent about outside funding. Wow, they really have not done this. It shouldn't take downloading or reviewing multiple PDFs from an online 990 tracker to figure out the amount of outside funding an evangelical school, university, or ministry has received. If you get a grant, talk about it, unless there are certain restrictions from them doing so. And if there are restrictions, determine if those are worth the benefits. Again, we did the live stream on the dirty money in evangelicalism.
Yeah.
They are the ones who are funded. The woke church was government funded. The Zionists are actually our people funded, which is a major problem in the church. But the woke people were government backed.
It'd be nice if North American Mission Board followed this.
World Relief, those open borders profiteers, there's criminals, really. They are government backed.
And again, the whole people are going to follow the money thing. It's not really true.
I followed the money on our side.
The people that are in the know, deeply in the know, are going to follow. But a lot of the normies are not going to
get out there. Yeah, you want to know about the shady funding? American Reformer got $6 of indirect government monies. $6. So that's negligible. That means that they got money from someone who got money from someone who got money from the government. That's, I think, what that means. Because money is fungible. That's how indirect works, I believe. So they got $6. That's all the shady funding I could find, because I've actually done this step on our own side. I did it on their side. I did it on our side just for curiosity. And what I found was exactly that. Our money's clean. I didn't find any. Now, if there's LLCs, I don't know anything about that. Evangelical Dark Web's an LLC. A few other people are LLCs. Well, maybe they're getting some of that Qatari money.
New Discourses is an LLC.
Yeah, I mean, that's an LLC too. Number eight, be very open about normal organizational behavior, networking, businesses, and shared messaging. The Big Eva critique is often validated by people pointing out to ostensible set of related Gospel Coalition posts highlighting the upcoming conference talks on newly published Crossway books. Bring up being upfront about the business end of stuff goes a long way towards demythologization. Oh man, I'm struggling tonight. Be clear about how this important agents like Wall Gamuth and Associates are for professional evangelical publishing. Never heard of them. And to be sure, it should be highlighted that the Evangelical Dark Web isn't immune to from this critique either. The same individual's media company does communications for Pulpit and Pen and web design for the upcoming videos conferences page. I think it's talking about Cody Leibolt. Note the strategic cross posting and sharing between sovereign nations, Pulpit and Pen, 30 pieces of silver for the new Christian Intellectual and Capstone Report. Now, man, none of those are really still things in our circles, because Pulpit and Pen is rebranded as Protestia and everything else has fallen off. Like Capstone Report, like that guy is just kind of cringe. Like he's a William F. Buckley respecter. And it's like, no, William F. Buckley is an evil guy.
Yeah, he sucked.
He always sucked.
I mean, this is just dumb.
Barry Goldwater was an evil guy. You know, Richard Nixon was the right choice in that election.
Like, there's a difference between being transparent about how the business and the industry operates, which again, that's, and then the way he's saying is be upfront about like the nitty gritty, like, oh, who your publisher is or who your vendor is.
Yeah, they're not up.
But I mean, that's not really the thing that draws the scrutiny. It's more, oh, why is your organization working with the government? You know, why is Russell Moore taking money and cooperating with Francis Chan?
So you wrote this article, I'll probably change the headline, but disgraced FBI agent Brian Alton suspended by Cash Patel. So why don't you give us the rundown on this story?
I guess earlier this past week, or I guess it would have been Saturday, the 12th, Cash Patel basically had a hit list of swamp creatures, because he wrote a book called Government Gangster. So one of the many names he lists is Brian Alton, who's an agent at the FBI. Obviously, Cash Patel being the director of the FBI, and basically had Brian Alton in his crosshairs. So he actually suspends him. So Brian Alton, for those that don't know, is basically the guy behind Russiagate, the guy that was supposed to verify the details that were in the Steele dossier. And it's important to note that the Steele dossier was a collaborative effort between the Clinton campaign and basically an MI6 operative named Christopher Steele. So, and you know, there's probably some conspiracy behind who Christopher Steele is, who he was working with, and what his motivations were. But it's clear that, you know, there were a lot of British influences that probably wanted Hillary Clinton to win the election in 2016. So he was basically the guy that was tasked with the investigation as it being a Russia expert. Which then basically, you know, and a lot of the reporting for this, I mean, conservative media has kind of laid out a long track record. I cite links to the Federalist, I believe, for the most part. So he knew in at least 2017 that the details of the Steele dossier were, let's just say, false and untrue. Yet he was using the information in the report to procure FISA warrants. So basically you're lying on government paperwork, using information you know is not true in order to obtain warrants on unsuspecting people. In this case, that would be against President Trump. So the other thing he did was in 2020, he was responsible for suppressing the Hunter Biden laptop scandal and calling it disinformation. So that's the other scandal. So he's involved in two very high profile political I guess we can call it lawfare exercises done by the FBI. You're muted. You're muted.
And at the same time, he was very active in the church. He was in the institutional church, that he was trying to get Christian institutions to liberalize, adopt wokeness. And meanwhile, he's also behind political scandals. And basically, he was a Democrat operative in the FBI.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, I mean, he's been around for decades at this point, probably maybe two decades. He wrote articles for Christianity Today, I think as far back as 2012. His last one was in 2016. So, and a lot of them deal with, again, matters of security. So he kind of, again, he is presented as a subject matter expert.
Yeah, and that's part of why they had him write for the Mere Orthodoxy when they wrote that post. What else have you learned about Brian Auten?
I mean, one thing I'll just say, I did not actually put it in the article, is that the FBI turned a lot of its sights on basically, I mean, they might call it white nationalism, but, you know, basically on white Americans. And this is largely seen also with the ATF and a lot of their scandals. If you go back to like the 90s with Ruby Ridge, they're essentially trying to get a white dude in Idaho to saw off a shotgun so that they could use him as an informant over some probably insignificant crime, and they end up killing two members of his family. And then, but, you know, basically they weaponized the government against everyday Americans in the 90s. And a lot of the government shifted into more or less using informants and basically creating entrapment schemes against everyday Americans to get them to commit crimes so that they can then arrest them, rather than the FBI proactively investigating. So I think Brian Auten is largely a product of this, I guess, mentality in the FBI. I mean, you also see this with Waco, where the ATF intentionally creates a situation that essentially cultivated in a fire killing a bunch of people and also torturing them in the lead up to the fall of Waco. So he is largely a product of the FBI setting its sights on everyday Americans through, you know, various government overreaches.
Right.
And that's why a lot of his work seems to be very anti-white in nature. And that's what we'll get to later on in the article, of a lot of his work in the church.
Okay.
But if you read his article on Christian nationalism, he does a lot of anti-Christian nationalist propaganda pieces. Even the one on the evangelical dark web, he is counter-signaling right-wing Christians. Because again, his entire mentality in the FBI, and probably his entire agency, all the people he works with, thinks white Americans are the enemy. So I do really think that mentality is embedded in the culture of where he works.
Yeah, so you talk about that he's written for various evangelical outlets, Gospel Coalition, yes. ERLC.
He is listed as an author at the ERLC. There is no articles.
I've heard he's being scrubbed.
Well, that might be true. I mean, I posit the question of whether there was collusion between the ERLC and Brian Auten with regards to how they handled the Nashville Trinifesto. If he was consulted or if he had any influence on that.
Yeah, I think that's a worthy question to ask.
And again, what other actions he has had influence on? Because he's again, basically, and he also wrote an article saying that basically J. Edgar Hoover was responsible for like white Christian nationalism.
What?
And because he's again trying to sell the idea that the Christian nationalists are a federal op, and he's using his credentials as an FBI agent to do so.
And what's interesting is he is the federal op.
Yes, it's not even like a secret one; it's out in the open.
Yes, he's laying literally it on the table. A Fed. And not only is he literally a Fed, he's a Fed that's been involved in some of the most high-profile scandals with the FBI in the last 10 years. I mean, I think Russiagate. Yeah, that's 10 years old. That's less than 10 years old. So, yeah. Like, his track record is abysmal. You also bring up his church in the article. I think this is fair game.
it's fair game because he actually is a, I guess you can call him a teacher at the church. He's not like a pastor or an elder, but he certainly has done teaching at the church. And again, he has published his church on various publications, articles, and so forth. So it's
Redeeming Grace Church in Fairfax, Virginia.
Yes. So this is basically like in, you know, your standard SBC church, very reminiscent of McLean Bible Church, given that, you know, very much similar proximity. You know, Fairfax, you know, that's one of the liberal hubs that, you know, Trump was winning Virginia until, you know, like Fairfax City, Arlington, and maybe a couple other municipalities declaring their results. And that's kind of where this is. But I mean, yeah, it's an SBC church. They got a lot of affiliations that they broadcast on their website, including Nine Marks, which again, Nine Marks is very much situated in the DMV. And, you know, so a church like this is going to have a lot of people that work in government, works for contractors, works inside the Beltway. And Fairfax is just outside the Beltway. So in his church, he actually did a seminar in 2020 on the color of compromise, which is Jamar Tisby. So I know John Harris has done some work on Jamar Tisby's color of compromise back in the day, like old school John Harris. But yeah, he's basically, you know, in the church after George Floyd, promoting the anti-white propaganda of Black Lives Matter at that time. And you would think a federal law enforcement agent would be able to articulate, hey, yeah, the premise of BLM is actually false. You know, 13% of the population commits like 50%+ of the murders and all the other violent crime. It's actually, you know, Stop Asian Hate is not white people beating up Asian people. It's actually Assassin's Creed, Dark Shadows, except in San Francisco. Like, you think, or the kicker, you know, all, you know, after 5+ years of body cameras being, you know, widespread amongst police officers, it actually, you know, proves the opposite of what the initial advocates, you know, promoted it for. Because again, you know, body cameras is something that the left advocated, and it is completely backfired.
Yeah, Matt Walsh made that point. A lot of people are making that point.
So you think this guy being an FBI agent, this is how he responds to the George Floyd scenario. Instead, he's teaching anti-white propaganda.
Yeah, in a church setting.
Yes, this was through the church. I found this on the church. Because again, if you type his name in their search bar, this is what comes up.
And it's linked. This article will be published on the morning of Good Friday. So with that
and the second lesson might be equally as bad, because he did the color of law, a forgotten history of our government and how our government segregated America. This was in 2021. So this is kind of like your follow-up. Ironically, a book written by NAACP fellow Richard Rothstein. Unfortunately, his early life on he did not have an early life section on Wikipedia, but I suspect the answer would be yes.
I mean, that's a very colored person last name.
And again, you know, it's all about how it's all pretty much about segregation and housing and, you know, the government mandating a lot of this stuff. But again, I'm going to make the counterpoint in the article, as you can kind of see, is basically that segregation and, you know, discrimination, Jim Crow laws actually arose because of, let's just say, behavioral problems that came with integration. And, you know, this can kind of be seen in the aftermath of what happens when you remove certain laws. And you have a lot of unrest that follows. You have white flight away from the city. You have race war in high school, of like actual racial violence in public schools, which even happens right now. So you have a lot of destabilization in your community as a result of the Civil Rights Act. And even like Thomas Sowell, when he wrote Discrimination and Disparities, he actually basically talks about how a lot of the Jim Crow laws in the North came after the migration from the South. So basically, you know, a lot of the Southern blacks moved to the North and brought a lot of their, let's just say, behavioral problems with them. And that resulted in segregation.
It might not have even been as much behavioral problems versus just different culture back then.
Yeah, I mean,
nowadays, when you have churches that are overrun by liberation theology, you have a culture that's more or less given into or given over to matriarchal Marxism. Yeah, you know, things are going to happen, and You know, one thing that's worth pointing out is, like, you know, marijuana is like a black drug right now, and all these white mega churches want to be very edgy and participate in black culture by highlighting that we'd love to have you join us for worship on Easter Sunday.
But again, I mean, you know, there is a desire for, like, you know, say white people to appeal to black culture, you know. But again, a lot of what a lot of what he's teaching is just anti-white racism in the church. I mean, I don't really think there's any way to sugarcoat that. And again, using a NAACP propaganda book to articulate, systematic racism, you know, is a thing or whatever. It's like, no, those laws were enacted for a reason. Like, and you can kind of see multiculturalism doesn't work. Like, there's a reason South Africa had apartheid, and you're seeing in the aftermath of apartheid what happens to the country. Or even Rhodesia, you know, it was a successful country. And then what happens when, you know, the system gets destroyed from a lot of outside pressure and from within, that, you know, you get Mugabe and hyperinflation.
Anything else to add to the Brian Alton story before we switch over to Judaizers?
I mean, you should expect a lot of regime evangelicals to back their own on this case. I mean, obviously, a lot of the early ones at Davenant or associated with Davenant, because he was on the board for Davenant until maybe 2023 or 2022. So expect a lot of these regime types to back him and to have his back.
So you think they're going to circle the wagons? Don't think this is going to be Bane? I expect, they expect one of us in the wreckage.
They're already starting. I mean, like, you might see a David French article in the future. You might see maybe a Russell Moore or Christianity Today. But I think you're going to start seeing
that. Is there a possibility Brian Alton's profile gets elevated to a Francis Collins?
I mean, if he gets on, like, Holy Post, I don't know if he'll get that high, because Francis Collins was probably a lot more elevated, like, before his name started getting, let's just say, people started finding out exactly what he was doing at NIH. So I don't think he'll get that kind of treatment, but obviously he might get, like, a Paul Miller-esque kind of treatment and just be like a player.
All right. Moving on, I wanted to talk about the topic of Judaizing, because it's, you know, Holy Week, and a lot of Christians are kind of partaking in, let's say, Jewish traditions, because it's not really a Christian tradition. Seder meals and stuff like that. A lot of Christians are LARPing as participating in the Passover. And I've seen Joel Webben talk about this in a video. I also saw J.D. Hall write a Substack about that. Maybe I'll pull his Substack on that, because I thought he did a pretty good job. He argues that the Seder meal is satanic. So that's a pretty interesting, that's a hot take. He wrote a Substack saying the origins and folly of observing the satanic Seder service for Resurrection Day. So my thoughts on this are actually pretty simple, and I tweeted them out before the live stream. Unless you are sacrificing a sheep, you are not observing the Passover, because the Passover is about the lamb. It is about the lamb who saves you from the angel of death. It is about God's grace saving you from God's wrath. And that is what the Passover is about. But without that, without the lamb, you're just LARPing. And if I wanted, I told my wife last night, because, you know, I try to be edgy in the house. Edgy, I'm edgier off camera than I am on camera. I'm like, I tell her, I'm like, if I wanted to LARP at history, I'd be a Confederate reenactor. And I told her that, and, you know, she liked that. And it's like, of course you would. But I'm like, Maryland sent people to both sides of the war, so, you know, I can do that. We can do that in Maryland. We can do that. So anyway, this article, I'll pull it up a little bit more. So J.D. Hall makes the argument about it being satanic, because he argues that basically everything about the Seder meal comes from being formalized in the second century AD. And he says it's all post-fall of Jerusalem. So he says evangelicals should reject the Seder observance during Easter because it is a form of syncretism, a blending of true and false worship condemned in Scripture. The Seder is, as practiced today, originates in Talmudic or Rabbinic Judaism, formalized in the second century, long after the destruction of the Second Temple and fulfillment of the law in Christ. By participating in this ritual, Christians risk diverting their attention from the resurrected Savior, conflating Talmudic Judaism with the practice with the religion of Abraham, and engaging in what Scripture warns is a false worship akin to demon worship.
Well, let's actually go there,
because Corinthians 10:20-21.
Let's actually take a break real quick, and like the central meal that you should be focused on this week would be that of the Lord's table,
the Easter ham. Oh.
Not the Seder itself, because essentially the Lord, you know, Eucharist or communion or the Lord's Supper is essentially replacing the Passover meal as your spiritual communion with God.
Yes, this is my new covenant, which I established with you, or this is my new testament, I believe, is what the old King James says. You know,
that's actually what doubles the Seder as a LARP, because you're essentially using it to supplant the importance and significance of the bread and the cup.
I mean, it's already a LARP.
Yeah.
But now we're trying to say that it's a detrimental LARP, because it's a LARP because you're not sacrificing an animal. And people like, let's name drop, Bryson Gray. He's kind of a big, you know, he's a Christian rapper
with Hebrew roots influence.
Yeah, and he's like a Hebrew roots guy, kind of. I don't know what he is, because he kind of read the Bible and said, I'm just going to do it my way. And I don't think he goes to church, if I had to guess. If I had to put money on it, I don't think he goes to church. But anyway, he knows more than everyone else. And he's like, I celebrate the Passover. Like, you don't sacrifice animals. You aren't actually celebrating. You're not actually a Torah observant person. Like, all these people that claim they're Torah observant, they're not sacrificing animals, they're not doing anything in the temple, they're not actually Torah observant. Because if you read the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, there's a lot more to it than just celebrating certain holidays.
Yeah, because I think with the Seder, it's more liturgical and how, you know, they read the order of events. You might have a certain person at the table that is designated as the person that that says this or that. And then, right, of course, you, I guess, sing the Hillel, which might have actually been the real part of an actual tradition. Because, I mean, it does say that Jesus sung essentially songs on the night, but who knows what was actually original versus what has been more or less added in the subsequent century.
So he says that the Seder, to understand why the Seder is problematic, we must first examine its origins. The Passover Seder, as practiced today, is not the Passover described in Exodus 12, nor is it a direct continuation of the practices of the Old Testament. The biblical Passover was instituted by God through Moses, requiring the sacrifice of the lamb, the application of its blood to doorposts, and eating of unleavened bread in haste, Exodus 12, for those who are following along. It was a memorial of God's deliverance to Israel from Egypt, pointing forward to the ultimate sacrifice of Christ, the Lamb of God. This observance was tied to the Levitical priesthood, the sacrificial system, and after Solomon's time, the temple in Jerusalem, where all males were required to appear. So Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy 16 talks about the Passover and about sacrificing a lamb and eating of it. So, anyway. However, after the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 AD, the biblical Passover could no longer be observed as prescribed without the temple, priesthood, or altar. The sacrificial system ceased. In response, the Jewish leaders developed rabbinic Judaism, a framework based on oral traditions later codified in the Mishnah 200 AD and the Talmud 500 AD. This tradition reimagined Passover as the Seder, a ritual meal with symbolic food, prayer, and readings centered on the Haggadah, a text outlining the order of service. the earliest Haggadah text date to the second and third centuries AD, reflecting post-temple adaptation designed to preserve Jewish identity in the absence of sacrifice. So that is J.D. Hall explaining the Seder. And I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's important to know that the communion is what replaces the Passover meal in terms of a sacrament. That's part of the significance of the sacrament, is that it replaces the other sacrament.
Because I think it's not just bread and lamb that they eat that has symbolic meaning, but there's other things, there's other foods that are added to the menu that are symbolic. So there's a lot more to it than what is outlined in, say, Deuteronomy 16. So anyway, this is a growing trend in evangelicalism, and I can't help but think it's because they're kind of lashing out because they're not winning the next generation with Zionism. They're not winning the next generation with dispensationalism. Those are my kind of thoughts. So this is kind of like, we're trying to Judaize the church because they're falling away from these beliefs that, you know, didn't exist 300 years ago, but now aren't going to survive into the next 30
years. I'm not sure what the Seder that is the case. I mean, a lot of these things come from, I won't say outside ministries, but when a church does like a Seder, they bring in outside people to actually like do it. So I get, functionally they're hiring a catering service to have a lamb and essentially have a lamb dinner for their congregation and whoever comes. So it is more of a service that's kind of arisen. So because it's more available to do, it's not like the pastor of your church is just going to like, okay, I'm getting this lamb from this other congregant that has a farm with a bunch of sheep, and we're going to slaughter a lamb and do a Seder just like they did in the Old Testament. You're actually bringing in outsiders, and they're generally like some kind of Messianic Jewish congregation or something like that. So a lot of the prominence of a lot of these, I guess, parachurch ministries is probably what has given way to the practice of Seder being more common amongst Protestants.
Prominent, yes, but keep in mind, a lot of these organizations have existed since like the 1960s or
even
the 1890s.
How often have they achieved, like, I won't say how often have they done this specific practice, but I think it's become more fashionable because it's become more available. And a lot of these mega churches are kind of doing the LARP.
Okay. So you think it's an availability thing? I think it's a, we're trying to capture the next generation because we need to lean more into this because of rising anti-Semitism and stuff like that. I wrote an article earlier this week at Evangelical Dark Web, and it basically spelled the end of Zionism as a political construct in the United States, because majority of like 50% of under 50 Republicans have a negative view of Israel, modern Israel. 50% have a unfavorable view of Israel. They are cooked in the future, so they gotta lock it in now because they are cooked.
Yeah, I mean, again, I do
have no modern, like, the Israeli lobby has no future in this country. They are so done. They gotta milk it now.
Again, I do think there is some truth to the notion that, you know, a lot of the focus on Seders this year is probably due to the noticing, but I'm not sure if there's an increase in the amount of churches that are doing it because of, you know, 10-7. So are we just now noticing it and maybe going after it and basically
noticing?
we're going after it more this year because of everything that's happened in recent years versus our churches doing it more now because of what happened on October 7th or whatever else. So again, it's almost like a chicken and the egg thing, is who is actually the reason for pushing it or pushing it to the limelight this year? Because I don't think it was as much of a discussion topic last year as opposed to like, because again, there is almost like a topical calendar, a liturgical calendar of issues where every Easter is like, is Easter pagan? You have to deal with those stupid debates. Or the same thing with the Christmas debate. So there is a certain notion that
there's a time of the year where we debate whether the bugs are the good guys in in Starship Troopers. Yes,
we have this. We have these weird cyclical topics that
there's the David Bathsheba debate that comes up usually in the spring.
So is the Seder debate just a new topic that's going to be introduced into the liturgical calendar of debate?
I think the answer is yes, because there are.
Yeah, I think it's
I mentioned Bryson Gray, but there's a few other prominent people that think it's a sin to eat pork, who have never read the Jerusalem Council and in the Book of Acts, which says that Gentiles do not have to become Jewish in order to become Christian, in order to be saved. That they just have to not do a couple of things. And one of those things, or none of the no-nos from the Jerusalem Council, was eating pork. They never condemned eating pork. They didn't say that they had to get circumcised. They didn't say that they had to follow these holidays. And even the argument that Jesus celebrated these holidays, like the Feast of the Booths, which how many of these Torah observant Christians are actually doing the Feast of the Booths? Now, maybe they are, but it's less common, or you hear more about the Seder, you hear more about the Hanukkah.
So I'm seeing Seder having peaked in 1997 on Google Ngram.
Really?
Yes. And it dropped to probably a lower point, and it then dropped down in 2019 and 2018. I guess it's maybe a little bit on the ascendancy.
Okay. Anyway, this is a little thing that I wanted to weigh into today.
But it started going up after the 60s, just after 65.
So I'll do a last call for questions. But another thing that I wanted to talk about, this is a little bit brief. I did a video on the Kellerites on Wednesday. And another thing to add is that Psi-P theology is in retreat. Preston Sprinkle is running away from the term. The Kellerites are getting exposed. So I think we're winning again in this fight against what I think is one of the more this will gay the church, and we don't want that.
You're not going to win young men, those 18 to 30 year old men, by having a gay church.
You're not. You're going to lose the men. And that is why we need to crush this theology. And Preston Sprinkle, the leading purveyor of Side B theology, says, I'm not Side B theology. And his whole logic is that he doesn't agree with everything that people who call themselves Side B agree with. So therefore, he's not actually Side B. That makes no sense. Like, I can adopt the same label as someone else and not agree to all the points that they make that are tangential to the label. So his logic made no sense. So anyway,
we got this one right here.
How's the cancel? Okay.
Has anyone else noticed how violently the reform movement has moved away from the academic credential-based leadership to organic Socratic leadership? And I think this is part of what's like intellectual meritocracy in a sense, even though, you know, I think Stephen Wolf is actually a PhD in like political science or political theory or something. But yeah, I mean, people have seen what a lot of the, you know, let's be honest, what the academic institutions are putting out, what a lot of their work is. And this is not just in Christian circles. I honestly think this is true in a lot of other circles, sociological circles as well. That's actually why there is a intellectual dark web, is because a lot of these people were kicked out of academia. Academic Agent would be one. He's not a Christian as far as I know. So I think you have people all over the place that have been kicked out of institutions or canceled or whatever. And then they have to either start up their own institution, or, you know, they grow outside the institutions themselves. So within the Reformed camp, I think a lot of people are appealing more to those that came before the institutions themselves. This would be the Reformers. This would be, you know, maybe the 1800s and a lot, or even just the pre-modern people. So that's going to lend itself very favorably towards, I guess, organic Socratic leadership. More, again, more masculine leadership as well, because managerialism basically, you know, promotes effeminized leadership. And I think that's part of the problem of why academic and credential-based leadership as actually falling apart.
Yeah, I think there's a meme that I know more than you.
Yeah, it's, you know, I can go to
Watson walking into the hardware store. I know more than you.
Or, you know, you trust your doc, your Google search more than your doctor. Well, yes.
Yes.
I trust, you know, I can trust, you know, I can trust my ability to understand the Bible and compare that with, you know, historic commentaries more than I trust, you know, random pastor on the internet or, you know, PhD, MDiv.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know how many MDivs just don't know the Bible that I see on social media?
I mean, again,
I don't see as many in real life, but
I mean, you know, go back to the original article at the beginning with on evangelical dark web where they're delegitimizing the institutions themselves because it's like these MDivs are just horrible. You see what these, you know, what these seminaries are putting out. And I mean, that's again, that's the rise of John Harris is pointing out all the problems at the SBC seminaries. And when you realize that the seminaries are putting out crap, that the, you know, the seminaries are making these people worse and exposing people to these bad ideas and promoting, you know, church growth as a managerial industry.
Right.
And, you know, an average Joe can just have a library full of books and no more.
All right. Last question before we, this question. How's the recent cancellation going for you guys? So this is a reference to Joel Berry basically using me as a cudgel to go after Joel Webbin and Right Response Ministries, because I last week had the, you know, I was basically saying that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a bad guy on the day that, on the anniversary of Dietrich Bonhoeffer being executed. I said that, yeah, he was a bad guy. I don't see anything unjust about someone with their hand caught in the treason cookie jar getting executed by the state. I don't see anything righteous about someone with communist sympathies fighting the Nazi party. I don't see anything righteous about that. And he was part of the so-called confessing church, which was a theologically liberal and heretical offshoot of the German Christian movement, which was Germany basically wanted to make a pan-Protestant denomination. That's what that is. So they wanted the Lutherans and the Calvinists to get together and squash their differences. That's what that movement was, and I believe it predates the 1930s and all that. So I believe it goes back to maybe one of the Fredericks or whatever. So that is a long-standing German tradition or German movement to not only unify the Germans but also unify the church. And then you got Dietrich Bonhoeffer as a liberal dissident from that. Yeah, he was a bad guy. His theology was terrible. He denied the Apostles' Creed. And Joel Berry thought it was wise to go after me for that point.
He was the Michael Servetus of the 1930s.
Yeah. He wishes. But anyway, like he thought that people would cancel Joel Webbin for that take. And it's like in order to do that, he had to step on the rake of defending Dietrich Bonhoeffer's abhorrent theology. So good job, Joel Berry. I think it's positive. Now that's a joke. I get that joke. Anyway, I think that's all we got.
Let me just point out this. Yeah, this actually summarizes a lot of what I'm saying, because, again, when you could have a library full of books that teaches you better than a college institution, then that undermines the credibility of the institution. And, again, you see this with Harvard. They're pumping up GPAs while also now offering remedial courses, despite the fact that you shouldn't be remedial at an Ivy League. But, yes, the rigor of the institutions has also decreased.
Yeah. What's his face? Andrew Isker wrote about this in Boniface Option that most people who graduate Harvard now could not pass the entrance exam from the 1860s. So anyway, I believe that's all we got for tonight. My name is Ray. This is Anthony. This is the Evangelical Dark Web. If you like this live stream, do also subscribe to the channels of the podcast. If you are new, have a blessed day. Stay based. Christ is King. And we will catch you on the next one.